in that regard. I mean, like, there's two pieces to this. One is that, again, the people we entrusted, the companies we entrusted to manage our media ecosystem, right, like both in terms of distribution and profit, are the same ones who are helping the bad actors profit and who are actively encouraging the bad faith behavior, right? Like Facebook, we know Facebook prioritized anger-inducing headlines from news stories, and we know that news outlets started making their headlines more anger-inducing to satisfy the Facebook algorithm. That, in turn, made people crazy, distrustful, and furious.
Yeah, I mean, I was inside Google years ago. I went and did a tour, and they were showing me how they just purchased YouTube, and they had these experimental videos going, and they were watching them to see when people would click off or what they'd rewind on. And they were taking all that data to really make the most viral videos and to find those moments. And I'm sure all the social media platforms are doing that. And one of the things that's really different from traditional advertising to what Facebook sells or what any of the platforms sell is they're not just selling your eyeballs. That's what we used to do in media. Look at this ad, maybe you'll buy it. But what the social media platforms have gotten very good at because of the data that they collect on us is that they're able to sell the fact that they can change human behavior. And that's a part of it, right?
I don't think every single news outlet has fully realized the degree to which Facebook and Google has altered their editorial practices in a very negative way. And, you know, to bring this always back to this end point, we have to recognize that our quality has gone down. When Donald Trump says, you know, the journalists are the enemy of the people, they're not out for you, they're not looking after you, to some degree, he's right. People believe it because to some degree, it's not just that they're idiots or brainwashed. They've watched the decline in quality from their local TV station, from the local talk radio, from their local newspaper. They've watched how these outlets have gone into high anger, high emotion content to satisfy the algorithms. They've experienced the real, noticeable, tangible decline in the quality of journalism, and they're reacting to it. And if we just keep looking at them and saying, oh, you just need more media literacy. Oh, you just need to be told how great we are. Oh, you just need to stop listening to the bad actors. Like, we're not solving for the foundational problem, which is that we are producing a worse product than we ever have. And people are responding rationally and irrationally to it.
I just feel like a worse product sells better.
This specific context mm-hmm. where the terms are dictated largely by Google, Facebook, et cetera, right? I mean, that's the big reason I just decided I step back from Twitter. Just like, I can't stand this fact that it's one thing for a social media site to stumble its way towards, you know, the worst version of itself, or to have that way through a series of whatever opaque decisions. But for someone to theatrically and flamboyantly and very much in public deliberately redesign the terms of something to very explicitly encourage the worst of it, you know, I had to confront the ethics of, like, why would I still choose to spend time there and play on those terms? I mean, you know, Facebook is easier to walk away from than Google is. Google is still foundational and Facebook mm-hmm. is still around somehow.
And we are still helping finance this. Like, Government of Canada outlets, you know, Canadian journalism publications are paying for ads or blue check marks or gold check marks on Twitter. They're paying for ads on Facebook. They're paying ads through Google AdWords. Like, we are continuing to finance our own defeat. Like, how sad is that?
That's your Candleland. You can email me at Karen@candleland.com. That's Karen with a Y because my parents were creative and spelt it differently. Our website is candleland.com. That episode was reported by me, Karen Pugliese, with help from Jonathan Goldsby and production support from Cherise Sucharin. It was edited by Caleb Thompson. Theme music by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
Matea Roach, host of The Backbench, champion of Jeopardy, Canada Reads, and via unauthorized effigy, a scarecrow contest in a Nova Scotia town whose name I can't quite recall.
Yeah, my likeness won, I believe, first prize in a scarecrow contest in Inganish. Great honor. And it's a great honor to be here. Thanks, Jonathan.
Thanks for coming back to Shortcuts.
It's always a fun time to chat with you.
Today on the show, Canada soccer spies victory as the Olympics drone on. Welcome back to Shortcuts, where we talk about the news.
Kiwi athletes are at the centre of an espionage scandal at the Paris Olympics.
Spying, drone reconnaissance, sent home in disgrace. Yes, a scandal's erupting that gives the Olympics all the makings of a movie thriller. At the centre, our football ferns. Their practice sessions filmed twice by a drone. The culprits, Canada.
Now, that incident was reported to police, and then it was found that the person who was operating the drone was a supporting member of the Canadian women's football team, Canada being the first team the footy ferns will face during pool play at these games.
I love the New Zealand accent, and I love we have the clip of them referring to the footy member. I'm not a sports person. I don't say that as a point of pride, just as a matter of fact. So I appreciate that this Canada soccer scandal is a sort of self-evident malpractice that even non-sports people like me can easily wrap our heads around. Kind of like how you don't really have to be super into musical theater to appreciate that the Spider-Man musical was a career low point for everyone involved. And in both cases, perhaps the lesson is that flying things over people's heads isn't itself a way to win admirers, necessarily. In the present case, so on Monday, July 22nd, so about a week and a half ago, the New Zealand's Olympic soccer, or as they call it, football or footy, the women's team, spotted a drone hovering over their practice. They alerted security, which alerted police, who were able to follow it down to the person operating it. They took him into custody, charging him for flying an unmanned aircraft in restricted airspace, and quickly figured out he was an analyst with the Canadian women's team, which was about to go face-to-face with New Zealand, and it wasn't even the first practice of theirs he'd spied on. Initially, the Canadian Olympic Committee kind of sort of tried to downplay who this person was and what his role with it was, but things, you know, because the police had access to, you know, his devices and stuff, it very quickly spiraled and opened up, and it became clear that this wasn't limited to one person or one match or one team or one day or one week, but in fact seems to have been a practice, regular practice of both Canadian men's and women's soccer teams for several years, at least. As a result, the Canadian women's team at the Olympics was docked 6 points, which does not, as I first inferred, mean that they were docked six, like, goals, but rather six tournament points. Matea, as someone who yourself has accumulated points in tournaments, could you explain a bit how this works?
Yeah, for sure. So basically, the sanction that FIFA imposed on Team Canada is this, like, points docking within the group stage. So in soccer tournaments and also in regular season play in things like the Premier League and MLS, soccer teams are awarded 3 points for a win, 1 point for a draw, and no points, of course, for a loss. The idea being that, you know, you should be rewarded like a little bit for a draw, but a win is supposed to be worth a lot more. So essentially, like, a 6-point penalty is pretty significant in the sense that it's giving Team Canada in the Olympic tournament this, like, 2-game deficit that they've been actually managing to come back from quite admirably. They won their first 2 games against New Zealand and against France, which leaves them with 2 victories, but, like, 0 points in group stage play. So I guess the idea with giving the team this penalty was trying to, you know, negate any sort of possible competitive advantage that they might have gained through the use of drones. And also just, I think, to send a message that this sort of behavior on the part of a soccer team, on the part of coaching staff, is, like, not going to be taken lightly by FIFA. And it seems almost maybe like it's more of a deterrent in case any other countries think that they're going to be clever and try and use drones to gain an advantage.
I mean, so yeah, it effectively, I guess, nullified their first 2 wins. But I mean, a lot of the question, a lot of the discussion has been around, is it a fair or proportionate punishment if it's something that was done by coaching staff, presumably without the player's knowledge? Is it fair to punish the whole team? And it sort of starts to get into and engage with larger questions of individual versus collective responsibility for malpractice, who benefits from systems that are unfair or cheating? What does complicity mean? And how do we talk about team sports versus other sports in that way? You're into cycling, right?
Yeah, I followed cycling quite intensively, I would say, from the time I was about 5 up until my like late teens, early 20s. And I still sort of like pay attention to it. It's just become a lot harder to find actually on television in Canada and on streaming. The reason I would argue why it's now very difficult to find is I would say like the popularity of cycling in North America really got kneecapped by the successive doping scandals that everybody probably remembers that broke in the sort of like late aughts through the 2010s, kind of revealing the extent of a systemic culture of doping, specifically surrounding Lance Armstrong's U.S. Postal team, but throughout the sport as a whole. The success of U.S. Postal was really foundational to growing the sport in Canada and the United States. And when all of that was kind of revealed to have been built on a bed of lies, I think some people would frame it as, I would say that like interest in the sport in North America really seems to have dwindled. I know a lot about this sort of like individual versus collective responsibility sort of calculus from that lens. And I think it's really difficult in a case like this drone spying affair that we've seen with the Canadian women's national team, first of all, to know like who was actually in on it. We've seen a number of former women's national team players, Christine Sinclair, you know, the former captain, Steph Labbe, the former goalkeeper, saying that they never saw any footage that they believe to have been taken through the use of a drone or acquired through espionage. Both of them denied having any knowledge of any of this taking place or there having been this sort of systemic programmatic spying during their time with the women's national team. At the same time, though, even if we accept this idea that the players had like no clue that any of this was going on, presumably you're acquiring this footage because you in some way want to transmit some kind of information that you're gaining through the spying to the players. The way that I've heard it talked about is like you are trying to perhaps learn information that might be useful if the game goes to penalty kicks, right? Which way is the keeper likely to go? Which players are likely to go which way when they have a PK? Are they going to like shoot left, shoot right? Are they going to try to go up, down, whatever? Like what sort of tactics are being adopted? It's really, really difficult to actually determine, I think, like to what extent spying then affects the result of a game, right? It's also difficult in cases of like drug-related doping to say what exact advantage is being gained. But I think when it's like information acquisition and not even like a physical performance booster that we're talking about, it's even harder to sort of disambiguate like who even knew about this and who should get punished. I really get why the players are quite frustrated that they are being punished for the actions of like basically assistant coaches and aides to the team.
Yeah. It's been interesting seeing how New Zealand media has been covering it. I mean, it's been a bigger story here than it has been in New Zealand. In the New Zealand Herald, they called it the Scott scandal dirtier than the Sen. And in a column by Jason Pine in the New Zealand Herald, the kind of modesty you'd almost, I'm not going to read this in a New Zealand accent, but if you imagine it, it's kind of adorable. Perhaps most baffling of all is why Canada felt the need to illegitimately gain an advantage over a side they are clearly superior to. With all due respect, why would Canada, the reigning Olympic champions and permanent inhabitants of the world's top 10, feel the need to spy on the football ferns? That's the team. Friday will be the 16th meeting. This was last week. Friday will be the 16th meeting between these two nations, of which New Zealand have won only one, the first ever meeting between the two sides in 1987. And in another column in the same paper, where they're looking at the Olympic winners and losers so far, they identify losers, just about everyone over this Olympic football scandal, except a couple Canadians going out of their way to praise Kevin Blue, the head of, I guess, Canada Soccer, and Canada's Olympic chief, David Shoemaker. But at the same time, going very clear, like Bev Priestman, who was the coach, must have known. She must have known. And I do wonder about now this. On the one hand, there's these collective punishment and the ethics of that. And then there's the question of the assigning of responsibility and knowledge.
It's a difficult needle to thread, I think. If we go back to, I think there's like a couple of things. I know Ben Johnson's been like making the rounds. There's a new book about his initial winning the gold medal in the 100-meter sprint, the Seoul Olympics, followed by 36 hours later, that being stripped after a positive doping result, sort of the way that he as an individual athlete competing in an individual sport was really scapegoated and made to be this like evil, villainous character who was representative of everything that was wrong with sport, kind of the only cheater. You know, as years go by, though, 6 out of the 8 people who competed in that 100-meter final including Ben Johnson, like eventually are tied to doping in one form or another, or admit to using anabolic steroids as performance enhancers. So I think in individual sports, there's a lot more of this culture of like, we want to blame just the person who gets caught and make an example of them. Even though, you know, there is a bit of a race to the bottom sort of thing where there's this intense pressure on athletes, I think, to try and gain an advantage every way that they can, given how high the financial stakes often are, given especially that in a lot of sports that are like played in the Olympics, that's really the time that they're like the most present on the world stage. It's where you have the biggest opportunity to sort of make your mark, to gain endorsements, and to really like set yourself up to be able to continue competing for that like 4-year period in between Olympic Games. Like, the stakes are so incredibly high. I know with cycling specifically, like, why I find it such an interesting case to talk about in the case of cheating in sports is because cycling exists in this, like, weird space where it's sort of a team sport and it's sort of an individual sport. Like, you generally speaking win a cycling race as an individual, right? Prize money often allocated towards individuals, but you're working with other riders in a team to try and often, you know, really get one guy to the finish line first. So the whole team is built around getting them the quickest time over the course of the, you know, 3 weeks or some of the shorter stage races, maybe 1 week, whatever it is. There's this sense in team sports sometimes that if you don't go along with whatever sort of systematic cheating, whatever sort of systematic performance enhancement is going on, you are actively undercutting the success of the team. You're screwing over people that are your colleagues. So I think soccer is kind of, you know, the farther end of the spectrum where we're not really talking about drug use, blood doping, anything like that. But where, given that it is a team sport, I think there's a lot more of this systematic element. It's a lot harder to like scapegoat one person. I think what would be really unfortunate as a result of this scandal is if a shadow is just sort of cast over the entire Canadian soccer program in such a way that kind of like undercuts the public's willingness to engage with it, right? What I really fear is, you know, Canadian soccer is in this moment where it's, the game has been growing. This scandal breaking at this crucial moment in the development of the game in Canada could really set back a lot of progress in growing the game that's been made. And I think that would be a very sad thing.
And then one of the things that has changed in the past few decades since Ben Johnson is, at the time, it took some time to, well, for one thing, he denied it initially, but it took some time, and I think an inquiry, to sort of get to the bottom of how prevalent was this idea of doping, who knew what, who gave it to him, and how did the actual system work? Whereas now we have emails, and FIFA has possession of many of these. And so they have, like, Canada tried to appeal this penalty, they denied it, and, you know, in the report they excerpt, they have these emails. Rick Westhead reported on it for TSN this morning, and go really deep in the FIFA website to find it. They have a whole like legal.fifa.com, and like, oh, I didn't know sports had all this whole, wow, this is really just a quasi-judicial side. But there's a thing where with the coach Bev Priestman, some email correspondence between her and between some other analyst who said he was mortally uncomfortable with spying, using the word spying. And then she turns around and writes to Human Resources. Hi. Seeking your advice and input here regarding this formal email on spying, it's something the analyst has always done, and I know there's a whole operation on the men's side with regards to it. And she goes on and says, basically, yesterday in a meeting, I asked Redacted to propose an alternative solution, as for scouting, it can mean the difference between winning and losing, and all top 10 teams do it. So she has that in writing.
I also think the other really interesting thing from that email is that, like, all top 10 teams do it. But certainly in the case of, you know, the 88 Olympics, we found that to be true with the athletics events in those games. Certainly it was true with cycling. I think, like, the idea of fair competition is just, like, such a strongly compelling one that we really want to believe that cheating's not happening. And so we have to kind of, like, name these instances of cheating where people do get caught and it does get exposed in media as like aberrant. I think for me, as like a viewer of sport, I have kind of accepted that as part of the gig. And I very much am one of those people where I'm just kind of like, okay, we have to accept that there's a certain amount of cheating that's going on. And like, given that everyone has relatively equal ability to engage in it, if you do it smartly, it kind of doesn't bother me all that much. But I think that's very much an attitude that comes from me watching cycling. And it was so endemic during the period of time that I became a fan that I like had to just kind of reckon with it. I think for a lot of people, that's completely not the attitude that they have at all.
Yes. I just want to go back to what was written about Ben Johnson. It is generally conceded that Johnson failed as a tragic dramatist, and it is usually agreed that he failed because his genius was for satiric comedy. Oh, that's the wrong Ben Johnson. It's the wrong Ben Johnson. I wanted to read from actually a column from the Ottawa Citizen from 88, from September 88, and the Soul Games. This is a columnist, Earl McCrae. "Why did you do it, Ben?" was the headline. "I'll remember the time, 4:35 in the afternoon, and Beverly, his wife, waking me up from a nap and saying, 'You won't believe this. It can't be true. It just can't be true. But a Canadian track and field athlete has tested positive for drugs in Seoul, and the rumor is it's Ben Johnson.' And then she cried, Ben. She cried because, like all Canadians, we believed in you and respected you and maybe even worshipped you a bit and said you'd do it. And you did. And you made the whole wide world look at that Canadian flag you held. You made us a somebody in the eyes of the whole wide world. But the tears weren't just for that, Ben. The tears were for you, for the tragedy you brought upon yourself, for the incredible, unbelievable, indescribable stupidity of your act." And then it gets angrier. It literally says, "You make me puke." It says, "You twice."
It's insane. Normally I'm like, oh, whatever. Listen to the podcast, the show notes. Sure, maybe read that. This article, honestly, like it's one of the like most vicious pieces of writing I've ever read about a public figure. He's like saying his Ben Johnson's mother should be ashamed of him.
It's remarkable.
It's bad. It's really bad. It's well written. It certainly evoked profound, it generated profound emotions in me. I think probably not the ones that the columnist intended at the time. I feel like doping scandals back then, this was like the early days of even having the technology to like properly assess when people were using drugs to gain an advantage. Doping was like rampant in the early days of organized, specifically, you know, things like track and field, the athletics, sports, cycling, whatever, just because there wasn't really a way to like actually control for it. I don't know. Have you ever watched the John Boyce YouTube video about the 1904 St. Louis Olympics?
No, I have not.
Oh, you would love it.
Its route is drenched in the shadow of a crate and barrel. The 1904 St. Louis Olympic Marathon was a disaster. It was a story of fraud, thievery, raw eggs, rat poison, food poisoning, liquor, feral dogs, and at least three separate incidents of near death. It was the stupidest sporting event of all time.
So basically, this is about the 1904 St. Louis Olympics were like a huge disaster. They were organized kind of in tandem with the World's Fair. They went on for months. The marathon was like run in heat that is actively dangerous to run a marathon in. And it was on dirt roads. And there was like dust being kicked up constantly that like basically irritated the runner's lungs so much that people were like coughing up blood and stuff. Horrible. But one of the things that's described in this video is basically just like the use of strychnine. All of these sorts of things that people used to use to dope that were like considered completely fine because there was just no way to actually prevent people from using them. And so when the technology to actually catch people somewhat caught up with people's ability to cheat, I think it was genuinely very shocking. And there was this sort of veil of innocence that got lifted. And I think that that did happen in and around the time that Ben Johnson failed his doping control at the Seoul Olympics. So I think that that's kind of what's changed between 1988 and now, is that there's been so many more big sort of sports scandals, you know, even outside the realm of doping and more in the realm of team sports. We have things like the Houston Astros, like sign stealing in baseball, right? You know, there's that. There was like Deflategate in American football that sort of cast a bit of a shadow over Tom Brady and the Patriots. Like there's been a lot more of these scandals and people have kind of had to accept them as part of sport. Whereas in 88, like I think it really was this like shocking loss of innocence that made certain columnists want to puke, apparently, and say that any cheater in sports brings shame to his mother.
Matea, as you know quite well, we'd like to duly note things on this show. What would you like to note duly today?
So I would like to duly note that, as some of you may have heard, it's Brat Summer. Apparently, I was maybe the first person to introduce this concept at Candleland.
Well, to me anyway, yes.
Yeah, back in mid-June, I want to say.
June 6th. So it feels like a long
early
time.
Yeah, June. I've lived like 1,000 lives since then. Well, it took CNN a little bit longer to get onto the trend of Brat Summer. And after Joe Biden dropped out of the, you know, ongoing, like basically recused himself from the nomination for the 2024 presidential election, Kamala Harris became the presumptive nominee. Charlie XCX, the architect of Brat Summer herself, tweeted, "Kamala is brat." Now, what this led to was a series of panels on most of the major cable news networks in the U.S. Mm-hmm. trying to explain to their
geriatric audiences.
Yeah, that I was going to try and think of something a bit more euphemistic, but yeah, geriatric
Jeopardy age.
Yeah. Literally, that was what I was thinking. Yeah, they're bridge-playing retiree viewers, what Brat Summer is. And basically, everybody who works at CNN is also, I think, too old to understand it, and so they didn't, in my opinion, do a very good job. They're talking a lot about the color green. They're talking about whether you can become Brat, whether you aspire to be Brat, what is Brat.
Or is Bratness something someone is born into?
Yeah, yeah. Or do you have Bratness thrust upon you? What I would say is, you know, Brat Summer really has completely nothing to do with politics at all. Brat Summer is, in my opinion, about going to the club and grieving at the same time. There's a great track on Brat that's a tribute to Sophie, the iconic DJ and producer who passed away tragically in 2021. So it's about being at the club, thinking about your friends and family who are no longer with you, but still partying anyway, because that's what you would be doing with them if they were here. To the extent that Brat is about politics, in my opinion, drug decriminalization, should we do a little key? Should we have a little line? No one was talking about that on CNN. What I'm most surprised about, and maybe I'm just like, I don't want to conjure this into existence, but I'm surprised that we haven't gotten like a Merritt Stiles is Brat from the Ontario NDP.
Merritt is Brat.
Merritt is Brat. Is Jagmeet Brat? No, I don't think so, but I'm surprised they haven't tried it. We'll see how dead this meme becomes. And I'm sure that when it's just reached the point of absolute saturation, maybe next week we'll see a Brat tweet from the NDP.
Duly noted.
Jonathan, what do you have to duly note today?
Today, I would like to note duly another reason I am grateful for Canada's public broadcaster. And I mean this in a sincere way, even though this is not the most consequential of stories. This Wednesday morning online, they published a story, Why Melona Frozen Dessert Bars Are Suddenly So Hard to Find in Canada, by business reporter Jenna Benchetrit. So my partner, Andrea, really, really likes a different product from the same Korean frozen dessert company called Bingrei. She likes the Samankos, which are these ice creams sort of molded in the shape of fish, particular chocolate flavor, and our local Chinese grocery store stopped carrying them. This has left her very disappointed, and I never would have thought that CBC would provide a lot of hints to it. So Melona is this more widely known, more popular product from the same Korean frozen dessert company. It's an ice cream bar, basically. It's a frozen dessert bar, as the CBC so diplomatically puts it, because what type of bar it is, under Canadian definition, seems to be at the heart of what's holding it up. The reporter talked to the Canadian Dairy Commission, Canadian Food Inspection Agency, Canada Border Services Agency, and Global Affairs Canada to try to get to the bottom of these rumors that there was some sort of border dispute or dairy dispute holding them up, and talked to Bingrei, and then eventually she got some answers from CAsia Foods, the Canadian importer, who said that, you know, it actually has to do with the dispute with the Border Services Agency relating to whether these bars should be classified as ice cream or rather ice bars that contain milk. And so I don't know whether this is the reason that the fish bars, which are clearly ice cream, are held up as well, but the fact that this product has disappeared from stores or is slowly disappearing from stores, people having a harder and harder time finding it. And the CBC did, frankly, the work of a public broadcaster, the legwork to try to figure out the answer. And for now, the solution now is apparently they're going to start bringing a non-dairy version of the Melona bar that isn't subject to the same regulations and tariffs that dairy is. So doesn't get the bars back, but they got us answers to a question that I'm sure so many people wondered and would never occur to them that there might actually be a real news story about it. So thank you, CBC.
Well, okay. I am like a Melona enjoyer during the summer, and it has been kind of hard to find them lately. So I'm glad to know that somebody out there has the nose for news and is figuring out why I can't get my nice little purple taro ice cream treat this summer. Duly noted.
That's Shortcuts for this week. Matea, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me on. It's always fun.
Yeah. Anyone can email me at jonathan@candleland.com. I will definitely read it. You can also perhaps find me on Blue Sky, although I'm not even popping around there that often anymore. Matea, where would you like people to find you?
You can still find me in the swamp that is Twitter, at Matea Roach. You can also find me on Instagram at Matea Roach, and you can email me, although I don't really respond to that many of my emails, at matea@candleland.com.
This episode was produced by James Nicholson with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our production manager is Max Collins and our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.